Robert Sickles, and I'm here with Catherine Frank, and this is the cold open number 42, the French Dispatch edition. And quickly, Catherine, a note on numbering. We did a certain amount of regular cold opens, almost 40, and then the pandemic hit, and we started doing the cold open minis, and we did 39 or 40 of those. So now that the numbers have caught up with the cold open 41, which I just recorded yesterday with Tarek on Dune, no more cold open minis. We're just going to continue that numbering, kind of like a new DC, new 52 sort of thing. So we're going to go with, we're just going to be the cold open going forward, although we still may be mini sometimes. So with that numbering situation out of the way, how are you?
I'm hanging in there. I'm happy to be back on our podcast. I'm very excited. I missed it. But yeah, I don't know. This whole time since the last time we recorded has been wild, but what hasn't lately? So that's how it is.
Would you rather be in person teaching, or would you rather just be back on Zoom entirely?
Back on Zoom entirely. I didn't want to stop doing that when I found out that we were going to have to be masked, because I just find it really challenging, and hybrid class situations, not ideal.
Vaccinated and masked, even though everyone else is vaccinated too.
Everyone else is vaccinated because they tell you, but...
Yeah, I'm definitely over that. I'm really glad to be back teaching in person. I miss the students. I miss their energy. I love being around them, but God damn, I hate wearing masks. I'm just so sick of it. And maybe I'd feel differently if I had better eyesight, but masks and glasses are just the worst combination. And I have a couple times the last, as often as I can in my classes, we've been going outside because I want to see their faces. I want to hear their voices cleanly and just connect with them on that human level. That's so hard to do with masks, but it's that time of year where it's getting increasingly hard to do.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Also, like, they all come to class and just cough and sneeze the whole time lately. So I guess I'm glad we're wearing masks. It still kind of freaks me out anyway.
It is the Whitman plague, what has forever been called the Whitman plague, that always hits late October, early November, and lasts basically till April. But particularly bad at the end of this semester and the start of the next. And now we're at the situation where anybody sick has COVID, right? You just have to assume it. So it's been pretty challenging. That said, I'm still grateful to be back. But I am hoping for some kind of normalcy sometime, somewhere in the future. So the one thing that is normal that I have resumed doing with great pleasure is going to the movies in person. We live in a town with a nice theater that gets a nice selection of movies that literally nobody is going to.
I saw this movie completely by myself.
Get out!
Only person in the theater. Yes, I went on I don't want to say what day because maybe other people are listening and they'll start doing it. But I went on a certain day at a certain time. And yeah, I was literally the only person in the theater. Absolutely no one else at this screening. It was
wow. Annie and my daughter Tallulah and I went to see Last Night in Soho on a Saturday night at like 6. So it wasn't like the main showing, but right before it, we were the only people in the theater, and it was in the biggest theater. It was crazy. Wow. It was crazy. Wow. The opening weekend.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, it was just a matter of time before I'm going to see as many movies as I can because I'm afraid we're going to lose that theater.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I've really been wanting to do is, for some reason, that theater gets like a really amazing variety of anime movie screenings. The only problem is there's always like seats already taken when I look at it, but I think it's my students. I think it's the students from like the global comics class, because they're like me, they're all big into anime. So
there is a large contingent of Whitman students that are into that. And they also typically play the at least once a month, there's a TNT or a TMC classic movie that plays. And I've seen several in the theater, and that's super fun too. Also, like nobody's there. I saw Citizen Kane by myself. I saw Willy Wonka by myself. Like, it's just kind of crazy. You're with my kids at any rate. Well, let's talk about the French Dispatch and your experience with it. What were your expectations going in and what did you make of it?
I had not read anything about it. I didn't even know what the premise was. All I knew was new Wes Anderson movie. And then you had asked me if I was wanting to go see it so we could talk about it. And I was like, oh yeah, let's do that. So I literally had no idea what it was about. I didn't know that it was like broken up into the different sections. I didn't know it was about a magazine or a newspaper. I didn't know any of that. So I basically had no expectations. I just figured it was gonna be Wes Anderson-y, and it was, which is what I was expecting. I didn't expect the anthology format, though I did like it, perhaps because I've been at home so long, just watching movies at home and like pausing to do stuff, that I think my attention span is not as good as it once was. So it was nice that the movie is like under 2 hours and is broken up into like four different pieces. So I felt like I could pay attention.
Yeah, and they're discreet. Right. And so for me, that was part of the skill of this movie, is its triptych structure, with the beginning piece narrated by Owen Wilson as the bicycling reporter. And then the end, of course, is the obituary. But it's rather fascinating when you think that he basically was like, if I were to create an issue of The New Yorker from scratch, what would my content be? So he created it and then he filled it out with the stories that he wanted, but then he assumed the voice of very distinct writers. So I just thought it was like a real testament to his skill that he often doesn't get credit for. People talk about Westworld and they talk about the twee quality of it, and his visual characteristics, which are very distinct, right? A Wes Anderson film looks like a Wes Anderson film. And I think he is undervalued as a writer. Like, I think he writes great dialogue, and that skill was just, he wasn't the sole writer, but actually he was the sole screenplay. There were other people that were involved in the story, Roman Coppola and Jason Schwartzman and Hugo Guinness, all of whom he's collaborated with before. But to write in three such wonderfully distinct voices, and actually four if you count the Owen Wilson, the Saint Germain kind of story about Ennui sur Blasé at the beginning, that was kind of spectacular. But I just thought it was really fascinating the way that he structured it.
And I agree with you that I thought it was really skillful the way that all the perspectives were very distinct. And even though the characters and the situations are kind of outsized or absurd, right? That the narrative voice, I think, in each of these is actually pretty, I don't want to say relatable, but like it feels real. The emotion of it is real. And that's what I really liked about like Grand Budapest Hotel, for instance. Like, so much silly and like really absurd stuff happens in that movie, but the connection that you get with the main character, who is the narrator, like feels very real. That's how I felt about this movie as well, particularly, I guess it's the last two stories, the Frances McDormand one and the Jeffrey Wright one. I thought those were incredible. I thought they were moving, even though, again, the situations are totally absurd, right?
No, I completely agree. And I've actually seen this film twice. I saw it the first time, like I told you, in an almost empty theater. But I actually took my intro to film and my intro to filmmaking class to see this last Tuesday night. And it was really wonderful to see it with them, because I saw it and I thought it would just be fun to see it with them. It is the most Wes Anderson movie ever made. It is Wes Anderson on crack with a big couple fingers of crank and maybe some acid like thrown in. It is just like the most Wes Anderson movie ever. And these things that he's just done in movie after movie after movie, like the wonderful chase scene, the animated chase sequence at the end, but that's right out of Grand Budapest, right? And there's actually similar sequences in Fantastic Mr. Fox. And then this like recurrence of theatricality, like the plays that occur in Rushmore and Moonrise Kingdom and the plays that are in Tenenbaum as well, where Margot Tenenbaum is literally a playwright. Just like these flourishes that were included, but were even more flourishy. Can I say that? Does that make sense? It was just almost a parody of himself. And I have to think that it was intentional to just like go completely to the wall with that.
I have to imagine that was intentional. I don't think you could do that and have it come off still in an entertaining way if you weren't aware that that's what was happening. And I really like too the juxtaposition of just like the wildest, cartooniest stuff happening. And then the film does kind of like pause and breathe though for these really emotional moments. I'm thinking particularly of that last story where it's literally a cartoon. Everything is silly. It's very over the top. But the part then where he's talking to Stephen Park's character, whose name is Lieutenant Ness Caffier, like the whole thing is ridiculous, right? But the part where they're having that conversation in the hospital is actually like made me emotional when he was talking about why he ate the poisoned like food. I was just like, oh my God. Like that's impressive. I think that you can go from something so silly that feels like it could almost just be like style over substance to then actually a really touching or like really beautiful kind of moment like that. I found very impressive. I wasn't necessarily expecting that, especially once I realized what the conceit of the film was. And I was like, oh, this is going to be like, I guess some kind of, you know, parody of this style of magazine or whatever. But actually it touched me more than I thought it would.
And it's kind of neat that it was literally a section that he had thrown away, that Bill Murray asked him to retrieve, and then to see that, and just the idea that you know, you're all strangers in that city, or you're not alone as a stranger in that city, and we need to stick together. I really, really liked that story as well, and Jeffrey Wright as his version of James Baldwin was amazing. He was so good in it. And his intonation in the way he spoke and the way that he told the story was just absolutely riveting. And kind of the Dick Cavett-like figure that he was having this conversation with was pretty great as well. And I think that what you're talking about that happened at the end of the third story also happened at the end of the second, which was so funny and heightened and hilarious. And then you get this really profound moment in which Kremenz is narrating what she had written about the death of Zeffirelli, and that he wasn't a comet rocketing through the night, but was in fact just a boy. And as she recounts in kind of a cold, dispassionate way, his parents in the back of the cab on their way to identify the body of Zeffirelli. It was so powerful and so amazingly well-written, and McDormand, as she does, killed it. She was so just fantastic in that role, but it kind of came out of left field. It's like a farce and it's really funny, and it had the colors when it was in color was that really kind of like the Umbrellas of Schomburg, like feel. It very much had that feel of like late 60s French cinema. And then it just took a turn and it became very serious and very real and incredibly powerful. And ending with the idea of like the commodification of his martyrdom was really unexpected.
I appreciated too that the way it changed tone like that. I think sometimes when movies do that, it can feel very cynical, or like it feels like the director's like, ah, gotcha, I made you like feel a feeling, or I made you like, you thought this was funny, but now it's serious. But it doesn't feel mean-spirited when it switches it up on you like that. It feels just like, yeah, sometimes that's how it is, right? Like you're in a hilarious situation and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, actually something has stopped being funny. You deal with things by making them funny, like a lot of these stories, but then like the heart of it is actually something profound. But yeah, I didn't feel like the movie was like laughing at me for not realizing that's where it was going, which sometimes I feel like that's happening. And that's actually one of my least favorite things in movies is when I feel like the movie is like pointing fingers at you for feeling what it's asked you to feel. I really hate that.
I'm fascinated by your saying this. Do you think that this is a signature thing of Anderson's? I'm just thinking about all his movies. They're all funny. Like even the what you would do. I mean, is Rushmore a drama or a comedy? I think it's hilarious. I think Tenenbaums is hilarious. But then they all have these incredibly profound moments. The moment of Herman Bloom in the elevator in Rushmore, where Max asks him how he's doing, and he says, "I'm a little lonely." It just like, it hits you so hard. And, you know, Tenenbaums at the end, when Chaz says, "I've had a rough year, Dad," it just gets me every time. It's his gift. I understand that it's not for everyone. His visual aesthetic is so heightened and stylized that you never forget you're watching a movie. You can get into the world in a fantasy sort of way, but you never believe that it's real. He draws attention to technique and craft all the time. And that I can see where that turns people off. They don't like the way that it is. But if you like it, as I do, it sucks me in.
Well, and I think too that part of that juxtaposition between the way it looks and then this sort of shifts from like this kind of farce to something actually more emotional. I think a lot of other directors who kind of do what you were just saying, which is draw attention to the artifice of the movie, also I think are very cynical or like are like purposefully trying to manipulate the audience. Like one of my least favorite movies, which is a movie that many people think is great, and I don't disagree that it's well made, but I hate it for this reason, is like something like Funny Games, right? Where it's like, halfway through the movie, it's pointing the finger at you, the audience, for being entertained by it. And I'm like, you made this. I didn't make this. Like, why are you looking at me? And so I think it's easy sometimes to read that as cynical, like, oh, he's trying to manipulate, you know, your feelings with the tweeness of this movie, and it's not real, but yet he's trying to say something real. And so I get that. But I think actually your Umbrellas of Cherbourg like comparison is really apt, because that does a similar kind of thing, right? Where it's very kind of light and sweet, and then the ending, and really stylized, right? And then the ending is very bittersweet and kind of reflects a more realistic, right, sentiment. And like, that's a classic for a reason. And I don't think I wouldn't interpret this movie or any of Anderson's other movies as like trying to do that in a cynical way. I think it's sincere, but I understand why people would interpret it otherwise and then feel turned off.
He's a humanist. Wouldn't you agree with that? Like, he definitely is. And I love the melange of influences in all of his films, but in this one in particular, it's so heavily influenced by European cinema, and not just like the French New Wave and then the later French cinema of the 60s. But I felt a real influence of Italian filmmaking in this, especially in the cinematography and neorealism from that kind of era of Italian filmmaking. I got that sense that it was a heavy influence on this, but it was also really exciting. Like every time somebody was on a car or on a motorcycle, like driving, it was just really fun and exciting to watch. And it constantly amazes me how he is able to maintain the signature visual look as well as this recurrence of style and tone, and yet still create something that feels new and different than what he has made before. And this film has so much in it that has recurred so often in so many earlier films, while at the same time feeling like, well, he's never done this before. And it's what you're talking about, like that tone and drawing attention to technique. I can't help but think of Scorsese and Tarantino. Both of their films are very stylized. You know you're watching a film, but they're still about a world that exists. You get the feeling that they're they're making movies based in the world that we live in. And you just, or at least I don't feel that about Anderson's films. It's Westworld. It's his own, what the writer Donna Kornhaber calls Westworld. It's his own thing, his own place. And if you love it, then you like his movies. But if you don't, then there's just no, there's no point of entry, because it's there in every movie.
I mean, I think the only point of entry, if you're not into that, would be something like a Fantastic Mr. Fox, where because the whole thing is like animated, maybe people would be willing to suspend that disbelief that they're not willing to suspend. I do know people who that's the only Anderson movie they like.
It's funny you should say that, Catherine. It's the only film I've never had somebody tell me they don't like.
Yeah.
Of his. Everybody likes that movie.
I think so. I don't know anyone who doesn't like it. But yeah, and it's interesting too. I was thinking when you said Tarantino, it kind of made me think of like, one of the reasons why, and I understand why people don't like this movie, but I like it a lot, Inglourious Basterds, is because it's a movie about like all his other movies and his like love affair with cinema. And this is kind of Anderson's movie about his style and his movies, right? Like it's the most self-referential. So I totally, I understand. And I like see that, right? I think that's really interesting. One thing, okay, you're also a lifelong West Coaster. I feel like I can admit this safely in this space. Until I was probably like 23 years old, had no idea what The New Yorker was. I literally thought it was a magazine about New York. And I almost never read it. And I'm like, just not that familiar with the tone and style of it. So that piece of it to me, I think was interesting just to see kind of the representation or interpretation of that. But yeah, that really like doesn't mean that much to me, which I feel like is like a sacrilegious thing to say. It's the same reaction I always get when people find out I don't listen to like NPR daily. It's not something I grew up doing.
I am going to date myself. I subscribed to The New Yorker probably when I was maybe 14 or so, because I wanted to read Pauline Kael. And I don't know exactly how I found out about her. I just know that I did. And my mom actually subscribed to The New Yorker for me. And then after she retired, and eventually Sean was forced out in the late 80s, and Tina Brown became the editor. And I was a huge fan of Tina Brown's New Yorker, and Terrence Rafferty was the main writer about movies for many, many years. And I always, always loved reading those. So I understand The New Yorker, I understand the structure, and I definitely read it, but I was not a cover to cover person ever. I would read particular articles, and they had to be embarrassingly articles that I was interested in the subject before I read them. I wouldn't just read something randomly, but I always read the movie reviews. I always read the movie reviews. And I typically read the theater and the book reviews too, to be honest with you. But the longer long form articles, unless they were about movie or TV or musicians, I rarely read them. But I definitely got this. I definitely got this. But that's a whole nother weird thing. When we think of Anderson, he is a file. Like whatever, he's a cinephile, he's a bibliophile, he's a magazinophile, right? He's a file of all kinds, and he is obsessive. And of course, like he happens to be obsessive about The New Yorker and wanted to create his own edition from scratch. But even without being familiar with the magazine, it wasn't unfamiliar to you, the structure or anything?
No, I don't think so. I just was like, I was sort of wondering throughout the movie, like, are there references in here that I am not getting? Like, I'm pretty good with pop culture references, literary references, all these kinds of things. Most of the time when I watch movies, I'm like, ah, yes, this is a reference to X. But I was like, oh, dang, I don't know anything about The New Yorker. I wonder if I'm missing something. But okay, yeah, perhaps not. But yeah, I thought it was intriguing too. And it was interesting to me because Anderson is from Texas, right? And did his degree at Austin. And there's definitely something I think in the movie about like that New Yorker sensibility, but filtered through like a different kind of regional sensibility. I thought it was interesting that he said it in like the fictional paper is based out of Kansas, right? It's not actually based out of New York, which I thought was a cool and interesting detail. And I feel like when I watch his movies, even though a lot of them take place in very sort of like urban, like cosmopolitan settings, there is something that is not that about the way he approaches these universes.
And he lives in Europe and has for many, many years now. And he has a partner who's not American as well, a longtime partner. It is very strange to me that he is arguably the most worldly and cosmopolitan of American filmmakers as concerns his subject, as concerns the casts. You know, he has very international casts. That's something he's done for a long time now, or at least comparatively, like for most American movies. And it doesn't make sense for him to have sprung from the suburbs of Houston. You know, I always think of Ezra Pound came from Haley, Idaho. Like, how did that happen, right? How did Ezra Pound come from Haley, Idaho? But he did. And so too did Wes Anderson come from the suburbs of Houston and become this like icon of cosmopolitanism in a way that I think is very surprising and very fun. So let me ask you this, Catherine, because the one thing we haven't touched on actually is that first story about Moses Rosenthaler. And I don't know which one is my favorite. I liked them all for different reasons. I've seen the movie twice. The third one profoundly moved me in a way that it didn't the second time I saw it. I saw that story through the lens of Roebuck Wright, the writer that Jeffrey Wright was playing, in a way I didn't. The first time I saw it, I paid attention to the story he was telling, or the second time I paid attention to him and it became something else. That said, I cried both times in the Moses Rosenthaler story. It deeply moved me, and it was the moment where the concrete paintings went color and Leah Sadu as Simone walks in slow motion across those, and just the idea that they were all Simone and like that pure, unbridled, in many ways unreciprocated affection that he had for Simone. It just really moved me that you would do that, like that you would create that for somebody.
That is super beautiful. I will say, I guess, of the stories, that's probably the one that, I mean, I enjoyed it. Like, it's an interesting and entertaining story. I don't know that it moved me in the same way that the Frances McDormand one and the Jeffrey Wright one did. The moment that got me was definitely, like I said, when Roebuck Wright is talking to Lieutenant Nescafe in the hospital, that section that he said he cut out because it was too sad. And yeah, the sort of like, why did you eat the poison food? Well, because I didn't want to disappoint anyone. Just, oh my God, really got me. But yeah, I totally understand what you're saying. And I think the use of like the color and like you said, just the way the shot sort of follows her walking by, it's really beautiful. And I mean, who has a better just like face for that story than Benicio del Toro, right? Like, just the sort of like slightly mischievous, slightly deranged, but also just like openly kind of plaintive look that he has throughout that story is really incredible. He's great in that, really impressive.
It's really beautifully shot too. And these are the sequences where you get that feeling for, you get that feeling for neorealism, right? Some of those sequences in the prison and the longer takes that we get in there. Let me ask you this, Catherine. What might we think about what comes next for cinema? And I ask this because just today I was reading that No Time to Die passed $700 million, which is not the, you know, $1.2 billion that they hoped to make, but it didn't lose money in the way that they were afraid that it might after not releasing it over the bulk of the pandemic. But the flip side of that is the highest per screen average of any film on opening weekend since the start of the pandemic is The French Dispatch, which is really kind of unexpected, but it made around $25,000 per screen over its opening weekend. But the catch was, is it was only released on 52 screens as opposed to 7,000, you know, internationally simultaneously. But is there hope, like this is a big question, but is there hope for cinema after the pandemic? We know that those big dumb films that people are going to, and the No Time to Die is dumb, make no mistake. Although I enjoyed it. I love the Daniel Craig 007, but it was ridiculous. And it was almost 3 hours long. But is there hope for these kind of movies in the theater? Like, we've been talking about the cinema being dead maybe in the post-pandemic era for this, or has the announcement of the death been premature? What do you think?
I feel like it's premature. I think so. The conventional wisdom has been, right, that kind of the middle of the movie budget bracket has like dropped out for years and years at this point. Everything's either a total indie or a tentpole blockbuster. And I think we're already starting to see some of these mid-range like films come back. And I do think that especially post-pandemic, I think there's market for stuff like this. Right, that people want to go see something that isn't necessarily just like blasting you with sound and images and action constantly. The only part about this that concerns me, because I do think there's an audience, is like the degree to which physical theaters can hold on. And especially, I mean, the Paramount decree has a sunset clause now, right? So like, are we all going to have to go see these at like Amazon theater?
Yeah, I mean, even without the sunset clause, the Paramount decree said that movie companies, like movie studios, couldn't own movie theaters, but it never said anything about media behemoths owning movie studios.
Yeah,
on one arm of the industry, and then owning this. What about when, and who knows, you know, they never thought in 1948, beyond their wildest dreams, that these companies would actually own like streaming services, like not only, like, which is much more monopolistic than a movie theater, right? It comes directly to you into your home without middle people at all. So this film, it threads a needle in the context of what we're talking about. It cost $25 million, but it would have cost a lot more if it wasn't Wes Anderson that made it, because people want to work with him. They're willing to take less money to do it. He is not necessarily concerned. I'm sure he wants to make a living, but he's not trying to make, you know, multi-hundreds of million dollar blockbusters. And who knows what this will end up making. His films usually make a little more abroad than they do here, but you know, it doesn't have to make a ton of money to be successful. And then kind of like the third leg of this, he can make a film like this for this amount of money and maybe be successful. I don't know how much opportunity there will be for other filmmakers to replicate his success. And he has a built-in audience. And maybe we'll find out with Licorice Pizza with Paul Thomas Anderson, which should definitely be the cold open number 43. But we'll get to that when we get there. But like the third leg that we didn't talk, if you have No Time to Die on this part of the stool and French Dispatch on the other, that third leg would be The Eternals, which didn't do well. Like, it hasn't garnered the effect. It's going to end up making somewhere just south or just north of $400 million internationally. And there is no doubt that that is far, far, far below the expectation and desires of what Disney was hoping to get out of that thing.
Well, and I mean, I think it's interesting that the last two major Marvel sort of tentpole blockbusters aren't released in China, right? Shang-Chi didn't play in China either. So I'm curious like what their sort of strategy is here. The cynical part of me wants to say they were getting so much heat for like the perception that they caved to censorship, right? That they were like, well, these two are, you know, we're not sure about it, star power, whatever. We'll see what happens, and that this is sort of like the way to offset some of that bad PR, or maybe it's an actual strategy that they really believe in. I don't know. I am curious to see how they talk about this, I think, is what I'm really interested in, or sort of where we go from here.
Well, Shang-Chi, though, was really successful. And actually, like, the most successful of all of them, believe it or not, is Venom.
Oh, I totally believe it.
Venom Carnage. Yeah, far exceeded expectations. So we'll see. I just hope that the world allows for more French dispatches. We'll end it there, Catherine. Thank you so much. It's so nice to do this again with you. So I'm Robert Sickles for Catherine Frank, and this has been the Cold Open number 42, the French Dispatch edition.